And good evening. I'm Bill Beckett, Program Director for Red River Radio, and this is Health Matters. Today we're joined by Detective Paula Marino from the Shreveport Police Department Sex Crime Unit, and also Dr. Bruce McCormick, a medical and family psychologist, and we'll be talking about the issue of how to protect our children from sexual predators tonight. Given the recent tragic murder of a young man in our community, which has shaken the community to its depths, this topic is most appropriate. In this ever-changing world where children are connected via the internet, text messaging, and cell phones, they are also open and vulnerable to those who would use these social networking tools to gain access and the confidence of our children. We know so many in our community are concerned about this issue, and what we thought we'd do tonight is seek out some answers to your questions about how to go about protecting your children, and, you know, at the same time, not being overly paranoid. There's a fine line out there between doing what you need to do to protect your children, and especially to prepare your children to protect themselves, and, you know, shutting down all access to them and cloistering them, as it would. Dr. McCormick and Paula, thank you for joining us tonight. And hopefully we'll get some emails tonight. You can email us your questions tonight if you would like at listenermail@redriverradio.org. That's listenermail@redriverradio.org. And if we have time later in the evening, we may open up the phones. But right now, we just want to take listener mail, and primarily because this is a really sensitive subject, and some folks may not want to go on the air with their voice, but may want to, you know, discreetly ask a question, especially if something's concerning you that's going on in your own neighborhood. You can discreetly and anonymously ask that question with us tonight. I think the first question that I have on my mind is, it seems like the prevalence, especially, you know, I just moved here from Florida, and the prevalence of sex crime against children seems to be on the rise. But I don't know whether that's simply a matter of the media jumping on and you know, over publicizing the event, or is there an actual factual rise in sex crime against young adults, and in particular children?
I can't really say as to the, if there's a rise. Our caseload has been consistent for about the last 11 years that I've been there. They seem to change depending on the season as far as adult cases and children's cases. We do have more disclosures sometimes from cases years ago that they're adults now and they're coming forward.
And that's, of course, what complicates the answer to your question. Do we have more events, or do we have more disclosures? Are our efforts to make it possible for victims to come forth working, or are there more predators out there? It's hard to know.
Do you think in the past that the social stigma led to more people just simply, you know, pushing it under the rug, hiding, you know, the facts that these things happened in their family and in the closet, trying to deal with them internally, however inadequately that may have been, rather than expose themselves to the community and the possible ridicule?
I see where the stigma does come into play, and sometimes it's more of a family issue, and that's how they've tried to deal with it. You have older generations that believe that these things were handled within the family, and they did not involve the police or social services at all.
So you just didn't expose your dirty laundry, no matter how horrendous it was to the greater community?
And regrettably, that point of view is still very, very common. I often see adults who were victimized as children, sometimes very young children, and may have gone decades without telling anyone. Oftentimes, I'm the first person that they have told, and yet they've been carrying this with them. And while certainly many people heal and go beyond, move beyond that, many do not, and they carry it as a burden for many, many decades. It's not uncommon, for example, for particularly for female victims to make their first disclosure at the time that they have their first child. And the desire to protect their child causes enough emotional distress and concern that they talk about what happened to them many, many years ago.
Do they typically seek out actual professional therapy, or are they going to their ministerial staff, or Where is this initial disclosure taking place? I mean, is there a typical place, or is it just wherever they feel most comfortable?
No, I think all of the above. Probably the most common would be to a family member or a very close friend, usually a sibling or a parent or something like that. And sometimes after that happens, then the other services, the clerical services or the, clerical services or the mental health services or law enforcement become involved. Do you see that?
Yes, actually we do see it quite often. Usually around the holidays, the family's getting together mm-hmm. and talking about their childhood, and things will just come up. They feel comfortable all of a sudden telling their parent about what happened to them. And the next thing you know, their sibling says, it happened to me too. And they'll take some time to discuss it amongst themselves and feel like coming forward. The way that the statutes of limitations have changed, a lot of those cases can still be investigated.
No, when it comes around to the holidays, is it the family getting together and typically discussing another family member who was the perpetrator, or maybe a neighbor? Because there, you know, like the recent incident, I believe the perpetrator was a stranger to the child.
Right.
But I know that very often, especially from my understanding of the statistical rape cases, the rapist is generally somebody known to the victim. And I don't know whether that's the same. Is it typical for the victim in a child sexual abuse case to know the predator or the perpetrator?
Well, I don't have exact numbers with me, but it does seem to us that it is more often that it is someone who has constant contact with the child, whether they're a relative or a neighbor, that they are familiar with the child and gain their trust.
Do you think that's another reason that it gets, if it's Uncle Joe, does it get brushed under the rug because mom doesn't want anybody to know her brother did this to her children, or dad doesn't want anybody to know, their brother did this to their children? Is that, that pressure on the family to keep it a secret a big factor in this?
Yes, and also that pressure on the child, depending on the child's age, on everybody loves Uncle Joe, using your example, and is anybody going to believe me? And they worry, the older children seem to worry about what it's going to do to their family to create the rift.
Yeah. And in my practice, those are the cases that typically show more emotional distress and more psychopathology, those where there was an initial disclosure made, and it was either ignored, or in some cases even the victim was punished or berated for telling a lie, which of course was not a lie. And we know from the research and the effects of abuse upon people, if there's frequent and repeated contact with the perpetrator, the chances of lifetime of emotional distress and psychopathology increase tremendously. So Uncle Joe's coming. Aren't you glad to visit him? Go sit in Uncle Joe's lap. Hey, let's make some cookies for Uncle Joe. Can be extremely difficult for mm-hmm. a victim who is not believed or just didn't feel like they could disclose.
Yeah, especially if they're afraid and they've bottled it up. Mm-hmm. I don't know which would be worse, having it shut down in you by somebody outside of you, or feeling like you have to shut it down because you're afraid nobody would believe you or would ostracize you for revealing the truth. I mean, that's got to be a devastating.
Both are bad.
Getting to the actual predator, if we were to list some of the common attributes, I know that, that they vary so much, but if let's say I've just moved to a neighborhood and I've got three or four young children and I'm sitting out on the front porch and I'm wondering whether somebody in my neighborhood might be a predator, what are some of the things that I might look for that would be cues for me to be concerned?
Well, the one thing I wanted to say about predators, it's not a word we use in law enforcement community a lot. In the trainings that I've attended and the ones I've given, we always want to point out that there's a big difference between a child molester and a pedophile, and they're not always the same thing. We see many cases and incidents where the one who's molested, the suspect or the offender, is he has a normal relationship with adults and has children of his own, and it's just the opportunity presented itself, and he crossed over. But then you have the other ones on the other side, the farther extreme, where that's their entire sexual preference is children. That's what they fantasize about. That's all they think about is having sex with children.
And that's from a law enforcement perspective, and we see the same thing in mental health. We use different terms. We call them fixated versus regressed pedophiles, but we see the same thing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of your question about characteristics, we do have some idea of characteristics that can be associated with offenders. The difficulty, as you pointed out earlier, is that these are often characteristics that are admirable in non-offenders, such as an affinity for relating to children and like to spend time. You know, is this an outstanding youth minister or scoutmaster, or is this someone who's you know, looking for victims? Because the process of victimization usually is, at least before the computer age, was one of more frequent contact and grooming and getting to know the child.
Building a trust and a confidence.
But perhaps more important, you talked about suppose you're moving into a community. I don't know that you can sit there on the porch and say, you know, that guy down the street always has kids playing in his yard. Maybe we ought to not trust him. But what I would like to mention is characteristics that are not indicators that someone is safe. For example, strong religious affiliation is not protective against that. Some perpetrators are very active in in their church and in spiritual activities, community service activities. I think in law enforcement, my guess is that you would say offenders can cross all lines. They can be the dirty old man that we always think of in the trench coat, or they can be, you know, the deacon in the church.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and there was, I mean, to get on another tangent, there was the BTK case where he was known in the community for years and years and years and was well respected, and you know, was secretly a serial murderer. And I'm thinking of the, you know, being involved in church, being involved in social activities as much as a shield to the identity as perhaps part of his real, or, you know, her real characteristics. Would you say that very often with the perpetrators of these crimes that they are skilled at using things like that to shield them from the community scrutiny?
Those that don't get caught.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember a case in particular where the offender had built a rapport with the parents, and he took the children in groups. So they're 4 and 5 deep spending time with him, and the parents, well, there's so many of them, they'll be safe. And little did they know, as soon as those children went to sleep, the offenses started.
And did the other children not know that the offenses were going on, or were they all being offended in that situation?
He had different groups of children, and he would pick one or two out of each group, and after then they would have sleepovers at his house, and after the children all went to sleep, he would victimize the ones he chose, and then he'd have another group coming in. And they're all relatives, generally cousins and siblings and things like that. But the mothers of those children told me that because they were going in such large groups, they felt safer.
And I think that the very admirable community presentation is not just to hide the identity, although certainly it serves that purpose. But I think for many offenders, it also is a form of what we call reaction formation. Not unlike the smoker who says, I'm not going to buy a carton of cigarettes because this will be my last pack, and they do that for years. Okay, I'm going to do all these good things, and I'm not going to offend again, and yet they repeat offend.
So they have every intention to stop very often after an offense, but
no, I certainly don't think that's the case with all. But that goes along with the dynamic, I think, of being a pillar of the community and an offender sometimes.
If you would like to get us a question in right now, you can email your questions to listenermail at redriverradio.org. That's listenermail at redriverradio.org. You're listening to Health Matters, and our topic tonight is how to protect your children. I won't use the term sexual predator, but from what term should I use if we were going to substitute a term?
Exploitation.
From sexual exploitation.
Yeah,
and so how to protect your children in general, I think, is a big topic these days. And our guests tonight are Dr. Bruce McCormick, and he is a family psychologist, and also Paula Marino, who is with the Shreveport Police Department Sex Crime Unit. And I guess moving on, I wanted to know, what are some of the ways in which these exploiters of children find the children? I mean, do they have a methodology to how they target children? Is there particular characteristics of the child that they're looking for that, you know, 15 children in the neighborhood, but they're going to select one. What would be the dynamic characteristics of that child that they see as the target?
It's really varied. If they're preferential, depends on what their preference is. If they prefer a certain age range, you have some that only are attracted to teenagers and some that want much younger children. If you have one that knows a lot about computers, he may go through the internet and the social networking sites to find them. We worked a case where he found a child on Pogo.com, which is to play games, you know, and started in the chat room there. If they're not so inclined to play on the internet and things like that, they'll do it the old-fashioned way and right there in their neighborhood for the children that are walking in their neighborhood.
Now, in the recent case, wasn't text messaging involved? How did... I've read just enough to know that the young child was texting and somehow coaxed into a taxi cab. But do you have any more details on that case?
No, that was investigated by a different agency. Okay. So I know about as much as you do.
Okay. But you do raise a very interesting point, some things that we don't know. Now, and Detective Marina, I'd be interested in what data you might have from a law enforcement standpoint. We know that the vast majority of victims of sexual exploitation typically have been acquainted with or known well, the perpetrators. But the electronic media, the texting and the emails and the Facebook and whatnot, is really a new ball game. There are many kids who talk about friends they have and they've been talking with them for months and never met them face to face. And I don't know that we have good hard data on how many, what percentage of victims are contacted and cultivated in that manner, but clearly it happens. And I think, again, I'd be interested in your opinion, but I think we're kind of playing catch up on how much is going on and how do you stop it, and 'cause it's brand new and it's evolving.
Definitely. A child's presentation to the world used to be what people could see when they were right in front of them. And now it's according to what's on their profile and how many profiles they have and how many email addresses they have. And a lot of them, I've found that they're creating profiles that aren't even reflective of their true selves, but they're trying to be cool, you know, like their friends or what they think that the world sees them as cool. So I've seen them in contests to see how many friends you can get. And when I say friends, I use the term loosely, just right, as the sites do, that it's just a big collection pretty much, and people that they never speak to at all. And adults are actually guilty of the same thing, that they're opening part of their lives to complete strangers. And if they're posting about having a fight with their friend or problems at home, there are, to use the term, those are true predators that are looking and they're hunting for children just like that, that need a friend, so to speak, to open up to.
That are vulnerable, that are emotionally vulnerable and looking for that social acceptance. And, and that's a backdoor into their psyche to draw them in and make them feel comfortable around the predator until such time as they can actually have a physical contact.
And even the physical contact is often graduated, you know, at first. Think about what we do with children anyway. We say nobody touches your body, and then we take them to the doctor, you know, and they take them to the dentist, and then we do all our home, you know. And incidental contact, bumping into somebody and whatnot is oftentimes not recognized as part of the gradient or the slippery slope, if you will. And particularly if there's a trust that the perpetrator builds up with the victim. So by the time something clearly overt happens, it's not that different from what has happened before, and it's so unexpected that it's very difficult for the child to say, is this really happening, and what do I do? And Mom told me to go with Mr. Jim and do what he said and be good.
And we do have an email question from a listener who wants to know, you know, exactly the topic we've been talking about. How do we go about protecting our children, given that they have so much access to a world in which the parents don't even know that these people exist? You know, I mean, how many parents monitor who their children are instant messaging, you know, and or on, you know, how many parents go onto the Facebook page and find out who... You know, and you see profiles on Facebook with no pictures. So, you know, of course, it's very easy to upload a picture, you know, of a 10-year-old little boy and, you know, you're a 40-year-old man. So even then, if there's a picture on that Facebook, you don't know that that's the real person. And is there a way really of digesting the dialogue that goes on these things to, because adults have certain, you know, kids have certain patterns of talking and adults can mimic it, but never perfectly, you know, no matter how cool we think we are, we reach a certain age and we are just, we're gone. You know, we've passed that age of being hip, young and cool. And unfortunately, I'm there and I don't try it. But what can a parent do to really, you know, without being overly intrusive into their child's life, to be protective at the same time? There's that balance there that I think must boggle the minds of most parents, I think.
And I think that's been the problem all along. It's just that we're dealing with different media. It's a combination of monitoring what your children do and teaching them to be suspicious if things don't look right or feel right. But it's difficult to know how or when. I once had a little girl that was about 5 years old talking to me at my son's soccer practice. And actually, I knew the family, but she didn't recognize me. And she talked to me about 5 minutes and said, "Hey, wait a minute. Are you a stranger?" And her mm-hmm. mother had told her not to talk to strangers, but she was about 5 minutes too late if I had been a bad guy.
Yeah.
So while we do want to educate our young children, we shouldn't expect young children to be the front line of defense for themselves. Similarly, when we have adolescents and teenagers who are normally a little more secretive about their conversations, right. You remember hiding in the closet to talk on the telephone, those of us that are old enough to remember that, they're not going to be delighted with you if you're reading every email. But if you have used the previous years to build up enough of a rapport that you can say, "Hey, I want you to be aware that bad stuff can happen and it can surprise you, and keep me in the loop here, and sometimes you're going to have to let me look at stuff." That's a start. It's certainly not an answer that's going to solve the problem, but if the problem were solved, we wouldn't be here on the radio tonight.
Mm-hmm. So. Exactly. And there are there's a lot of options that they can do. They can take classes, actually, to learn about social networking sites and what to watch on the Internet. The Northwest Louisiana Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, which I'm a member, offers such classes. Almost all law enforcement agencies offer that. I believe I heard it on the news sometime today that they were going out to DeSoto Parish to offer such things, and that will teach them about how these sites work.
These are classes for the parents.
For the parents. Mm-hmm. Sign up for it and create your own profile and have your child teach you how to use it. Become your mm-hmm. child's friend on the Internet. And then, especially on Facebook, you'll see everything they post. Yeah. I have teenage children myself. They know if they have a site, I have the password. If I can't have the password, they can't have the site. There's so much software available that you can upload to your computer and actually program it to catch keywords, and mm-hmm. it'll catch chat and IMs and emails and things like that. But then you're getting more into that. Is your child going to feel you're spying on them?
Right. Yeah, there's a trust issue there that obviously, you know, I think every parent, especially when they get to the teen years and stop trusting anybody over, you know, the age of 18 or 20, that, you know, the parent wants them to, you know, to trust them, but at the same time, you know, the child, you know, you want to let the child understand that it's a fear for you and your exactly. discretion, because a teenager very often doesn't have well-developed discretion to understand that this may look playful but could be tremendously dangerous. And for kids, everything, you know, looks like an adventure until it's not an adventure. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's a dangerous area that parents, you know, I have to imagine, you know, mm-hmm. having children yourself is mind-boggling. You know, how do you go about that without paralyzing yourself in fear?
Well, another thing that I suggest to parents, especially with the social networking sites, is that they all have a help button. And they all have a whole section on privacy. I have boys and teach both of them that, you know, you wouldn't want these friends to be in the bathroom with you while you take a shower. Mm-hmm. So that's your privacy. So on your page, you need your privacy, and only the people you really know need to see these things. And you set that at the most strictest that you can in each account to make sure that the general public, that Uncle Joe, so to speak, isn't searching for a boy his age and finding all this vast amount of information. I've noticed that a lot of our classes that we've taught these kids in our area is catching on, because instead of hometown Shreveport, Louisiana, they'll come up with something totally different of a town that doesn't even exist.
Right.
Make it playful and kind of turn into a game. But at least it's someone can't look on there and track them and know what school they go to. What is their schedule? Are they in sports? Are they home after school? Do they spend time alone? And things like that. So keeping it more to themselves and not putting so much out there.
For those who don't know, can you explain what a help button is?
Yes. Each of the social networking sites, and when I say that, I'm talking about Facebook and Friendster and MySpace. The amounts of them are overwhelming sometimes. They all have a section on how to control your account. Each one of them has a section that's help, just like in Windows. You know, mm-hmm. You push the help button when you're not sure how to run something.
Right.
You push the help button and it has a keyword search, and you type in privacy, and it will tell you right there how to make your account the most private so that no one can see it. If it says set it for only friends, then you can set it for only friends, mm-hmm. and then only the people you've approved. You can go on your child's account randomly with them right there, so you're not spying, and ask them, well, who is that, or how do you know this person, or do they go to school with you, and things like that. And that way you're not looking through their email and stuff, but it's kind of like a spot check,
mm-hmm.
you know. But it all comes down to parenting and talking to your child. And like Dr. McCormick said, building that rapport so that they're comfortable with telling you when someone goes over the line with them.
Isn't one of the phenomenons, especially with Facebook and the whole social networking thing, is that you become an international person. You have friends that are in India. You have friends that are in France. You know, it takes you out of your neighborhood. And allows, you know, kids the opportunity to do things that I certainly couldn't have done. You know, if I'd made a long distance call to Paris when I was a kid, my dad would have screamed bloody murder just because of the bill, you know. So, you know, children today have the chance to really do some cool stuff, some social networking with people around the world. And that's got to feel really, you know, for them, like they're involved in a much bigger universe than the neighborhood that I grew up in, because that was my universe. And the town next door, I didn't, you know, I might know a few kids over there, but I, you know, certainly never got over there to you know, play with them on a regular basis. But now kids can do things on the internet. I mean, there's all kinds of internet games and things that you can do. There's, you know, virtual worlds, there's Second Life, there's all of this other stuff going on that makes them integrated into a larger universe, so they feel much more hip and kind of, you know, part of this future world, but at the same time opens them up to all of these vulnerabilities.
I'm glad you mentioned Second Life. A lot of parents, when we talk about social networking sites, they automatically think of the MySpaces and the Facebook. But it's as simple as Xbox Live,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you can talk to people that you can't see.
Yeah.
And World of Warcraft is out there now. And Second Life is, that's something that we were talking about earlier with the law enforcement coming behind the curve. On learning about, there's so many different ways for them to contact, and just trying to learn how it works. So if it's challenging for us in the law enforcement community, it's got to be challenging for the parents. But just ask questions and have the kids show you how it works.
Are there, you know, we've talked a little bit about the perpetrators of these crimes. Are there, you know, if I wanted to see whether my child was particularly vulnerable, what would I be looking for? What kind of characteristics would I want to know to see whether my child was vulnerable to being? It's really a confidence trickster, it seems to me, what these perpetrators are. They gain your confidence before they turn, you know, vicious on you. And so what are you looking for in a child that might tell them?
Well, I think psychologically there are maybe two different characteristics that would make a child particularly vulnerable, although I think it's important to say up front that nobody is immune,
yeah.
and anybody can be tricked or put in compromising situations before they realize it. The one that we think of, though, the characteristic we think of the most is the child who has little self-confidence and tends to defer to others and is shy around adults and really idolizes, but is intimidated by older, maybe teens. who is very vulnerable to positive attention from those individuals, and they can be groomed and cultivated. But it's important also to recognize that very strong personality, high-achieving, active, interested kids, if they find someone who, particularly an older person, who is interested in or pretends to be interested in whatever they are, they're so excited and so interested in the model airplanes or the online gaming or whatever, and here's a kind of a mentor that can show me more, they can be very skillfully groomed as well. And again, as I say, or as I said earlier, the lines cross before they realize it, and then they're really not sure what to do.
What if parents suspect that an adult is contacting their children, what steps can they take? You know, if they're seeing some kind of suspicious activity on Facebook, on MySpace, and they know something's going on, you know, just from the way the child acts when they ask them about the question, what are the steps that a parent can take, both legally and just, you know, interactively with their child, to start putting up a shield around their child and protect that child from something developing any further?
It kind of depends on where they find out about it at, what level it's gotten to. If it's already went to the point that the conversation has become sexual, of course they need to stop all communication and contact law enforcement. If it's not quite there yet, but the conversations are getting uncomfortable and not seeming appropriate. We've seen where parents have, if it's on an online thing, where they've taken over that personality online and talked to the perpetrator themselves. If it's a phone call, you know, if they're going through the phone, I've seen parents that pick up the phone and call the guy straight up, call him and, "Who are you? Why are you talking to my child?" And that lets that predator know, I'm a good parent, I'm watching out for my child, and you're not getting away with this. He's telling me things, or she's telling me things and letting me know. And sometimes the offender will go on to someone who's much, much easier.
You know, our offenders typically designed to find the path of least resistance to get what they want?
I would say typically, yes. Yeah. You might have some that like the challenge, but typically, yes.
Yeah, I think the ones that we find out about far too late are the ones that are obviously the most skilled. I saw some statistics that the average arrested sexual offender has had 117 victims, which means for everyone that's had three victims and been caught, there's someone that's had over 250 before they were caught. So I'd start to say good ones, the ones that are good at it, certainly know what they're doing.
Know how to gain that confidence. Mm-hmm. Have you come across sexual predators that have actually been skillful at gaining the confidence of the parents as well, outside of the family? And obviously, Uncle Joe may have, you know, the confidence of the family that he really couldn't have done that, but, you know, the neighbor, the person from the church, or, you know, the scouting agency or whatever. I don't want to stigmatize any particular organization.
Well, the coach. I mean, you know, we've seen times when coaches have been through two generations just about and then finally was revealed and he had the snowball effect. I think you've seen that.
Same thing.
Detective Marino? Once you get one or two disclosures, that maybe a lot more follow.
Exactly. Every time we've made an arrest of that kind of situation, we always expect more disclosures to come out of the public once it's put out.
So once it gets out there, you're going to unravel a lot of hurt in the community.
Sometimes there's that child that's waiting for somebody else to tell first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A lot of times I see that. Yeah, I think you're right.
We've had cases where it was you had a younger child came disclosed and we started an investigation only to find out that someone from the generation before had been molested by the same person and didn't have the confidence until they saw the young one do it.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Health Matters on Red River Radio, and tonight my guests are Dr. or Detective, I keep wanting to call you Doctor, Detective Paula Marino with the Shreveport Police Department Sex Crime Unit, and Dr. Bruce McCormick, who is a medical and family psychologist. I'm Bill Beckett, your host tonight. And we're going to open it up for phone calls. If you'd like to place a call right now, you can call us at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're also going to continue to take email questions. If you'd like to email us a question, send your email to listenermail@redriverradio.org. That's listenermail@redriverradio.org. If I were a parent and suspected that my child had already been molested or approached, or, you know, something was going on and the child was, you know, closed up about it, what are the things that I might do to get that child? I mean, should I immediately take them to professional care? Would that simply close them down further? How can I help the child know that this is a safe place to open up about what's going on?
There are two very important issues in that situation. One is the well-being of the child, and the other is, and Detective Marino, this is more your area, but preserving evidence.
Yes.
But I usually tell parents when they bring children to me in that situation, or I've been asked to do continuing education talks to school nurses and school teachers and whatnot, my policy for myself and for them is typically, if you really think there's a problem, contact law enforcement first so that the interview information that must be collected and the other forensic information isn't contaminated by talking to your aunt, talking to your grandma, talking to two psychologists, three counselors, and the school nurse and the school teacher before they ever get to law enforcement. And by that time, it's very difficult, particularly with younger children, to get accurate information. But really, this is probably more your area than mine. So
yes, we actually tell them the same thing.
Okay.
If you have strong belief that something has happened to your child and they've been molested or they've been approached, to go ahead and contact law enforcement as early as possible, so that way we can get a clean statement. The younger children are interviewed at the Gingerbread House. Very child-friendly environment, with lots of rules involved for law enforcement so that the statement can't be tainted. Older children are interviewed by detectives with training in how to do that. So parents have a tendency that, you know, or some parents can lead a child while they're interviewing them without meaning to, that it's just that they don't have the proper training for that.
It's very important that the interview be done appropriately and done, as you say, under the proper circumstances so the evidence is protected. Having said that, once law enforcement has the information that it needs, then I do think there is a role for mental health thereafter.
Definitely.
And as soon thereafter as possible.
I was doing some research on resources. We were building a web page, and we will have a web page up with some resource contact links for different organizations. And one of them that I came across was actually training for professionals called First Witness. Mm-hmm. And I noted that was what their specialty was training for those initial interrogators who are going to be the first in line to talk with literally the first witness of the crime, which is the victim, and how to obtain that. Are there other professional resources that you all tap into that are available for school teachers and school nurses and other social organizations, which may be the ones to spot the clues that something is going on that can help them? And if they don't have that training, they can go out and apply for that training right now?
As far as things like First Witness, I'm sure there's tons of those kind of resources. Locally, the Sexual Assault Response Team, which is pretty much all your local law enforcement, the coroner's office, the Providence House, and the Gingerbread House, all come together to form the SART, as they call it. And they each provide that exact kind of training. We've taught SRO officers, school resource officers, and school security officers on what to look for and things like that. And we can usually tailor it to what they need.
And beyond that, each profession that deals with children, and this is everything from medical treatment to mental health, education, have the status of what's called mandated reporters, which means they are legally bound to report any genuine suspicion that a child may have been molested or abused. Also, by the way, any elderly person or incapacitated person. So each profession, presumably, within, you know, for example, nursing or educators or whatever, counselors, psychologists, have had some training in how to respond to that. Although, you know, sometimes it's been years and a little update is not bad, but that is that. Dealing with these issues is a topic that's often offered as continuing education for persons' licensures, certifications.
You know, when I was in college, I was a resident advisor in a dormitory for 3 years, and that was one of the things that they went through. A number of different trainings, how to deal with a medical emergency. I had a diabetic on my floor 1 year, so I had to learn how to literally give an insulin injection and also feed that diabetic orange juice if they had a diabetic reaction. And we did have rape crisis counseling, and I went through that on one occasion where a young lady, not from our dorm, but found by some of the young women in our dorm, had been, you know, attacked and raped, and you know, we had to go through that process of not necessarily counseling her, but shielding her from, you know, until the professionals could get there. One of the things one of my colleagues wanted me to ask you to touch upon, and I'm going to read it here, is the coaches in youth sport. If you could elaborate on, you know, there's all sorts of venues where adults who are looking to be predators can gain confidence. And I think we've had, you know, a series of things where it's happened in the youth sport. Can you elaborate on some of those situations, who these perpetrators were, and how they gained the confidence of these children?
I think the coaches of the youth sports was no different than any of the other offenders. They just had more access depending on their occupation. Most of the stories that I've heard about them, especially locally, they were just well-liked people on the outside, and very confident and personable, and that's how they gained that trust.
I would agree completely, and that's, of course, the thing that scares parents the most. If we look at people that we want to be our children to respect and look up to, their coaches, you know, leaders in their church, leaders in as you say, some of the scouting type programs. We trust them. We trust those leaders. And many, you know, a lot of times the parents were, you know, oh, I'm glad you're seeing so-and-so. He coached me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why when they're young, we watch them. And when they're older, we help them recognize when things are making them uncomfortable, and by all means being willing to hear what they might be trying to tell us.
What are some of the ways that children try to tell us without overtly telling us? What are the clues that a parent might not be picking up on that maybe we can help our audience understand, that if your child is doing this, they might be trying to tell you something that they just don't feel they can say outwardly?
I don't want to go on the camp out, or I somehow I have too much homework, or I'm too sick when we have the ball tournaments that are out of town, or well, if I'm going to have a sleepover, can somebody else come with me, or those kinds of things. And none of this is hard and slam dunk proof.
Yeah.
But if it's just a little odd, particularly if there seems to be some resistance, maybe my kid doesn't like baseball, or maybe my kid doesn't like to be alone with the coach.
Or maybe your child liked baseball for 4 years or 5 years and suddenly hates baseball.
Precisely.
Or suddenly hates football, or suddenly dislikes gymnastics or dance class or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there's a scenario where the same person is involved in four or five activities that you know your child likes, but this person is at all of them and they suddenly don't want to go to any of these events.
Mm-hmm.
These are kind of the when a child doesn't want to do something that's really cool and that they've always liked, that sudden change in behavior would be a tip-off that maybe I should be concerned?
I think any sudden change in behavior is a tip-off that something needs to be looked at, but certainly this type of concern could be one of those. And along that line, there's a class of victims we haven't talked about too much, and that's the post-puberty child, the young teen, the old adolescent who is becoming sexually mature and is more sexually interested, but still pretty naive. And it's very easy, you know, the classic and pretty much benign case is the high school kid who has a crush on her teacher or something like
mm-hmm.
that. But when someone works very hard and very closely together, this would come into the predator that you were talking about that wasn't a typical predator, but the adult and the child may develop an emotional bond that they both perceive as having sexual, or that moves across that line. And being aware of and communicating with your child about sexual matters and sexual feelings in general, as well as about specific persons or situations. Now, that's very easy to sit here on the radio and say. It's hard for, you know, a lot of parents to do. And there's some good classes about growing up for girls is one that one of our local hospitals has, and several others about, you know. And I had a lot of parents say, well, I gave them the book and said, if you have any questions, let me know. but
it,
my
dad
serve
said,
you
know, here's the book, read it. Other than the classes, how do, you know, maybe the clergy and others who are, you know, dealing with parents on a regular basis convince parents who are just so uncomfortable with going there because it's just not in their upbringing that, you know, maybe we've reached an age where we have to move out of where we were to where we are, and we need to change with the times. And so parents who feel very, very, very uncomfortable with doing that because their dad didn't do that with them, mm-hmm. or mom didn't do that with them, what can, you know, the clergy in our area and teachers in our area do to convince parents that, you know, we're in a different world, you know? Or maybe we're in the same world, we're just approaching it differently. Maybe this has always been going on, but now we're addressing it rather than, you know, not addressing it.
I particularly favor those approaches that provide a series of classes or training that invite the parents and the children to participate. And they'll sometimes split out and have talks with the parents about how can you approach this, and talks with the kids. And then once the subject's open, it's easier, a little easier to talk to parents and children together. And once that's been done, it becomes a little easier to ask them to do just a little bit in that way each week. So there can be some well-structured programs. So what can community organizations and churches do? Find ways to offer those to the community, because they do exist, although I don't know that we have a whole lot of them around.
I don't know of any of them in particular. But.
Yeah. Again, this is something that, you know, maybe our community... It's so easy just to think it's probably not going to be a problem and not be proactive in it.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I would remind parents is, I promise you, the kids are talking to each other about that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the kids know who the misbehaving adults are. But there's that code of silence thing.
Right.
So somebody's talking to them, whether it's online or at lunch at school or something. So, you know, parents... find a way or get some help to be part of that conversation.
What steps can a parent take if they've noticed, other than law enforcement, they've noticed that an adult is overly friendly with their child, and they don't want it to go to that next level where the law enforcement has to, and without confronting Mara, are there other social organizations or community organizations that a child can go to intervene in that before it gets forward, or is this going to be a one-on-one situation where the adult has to, you know, where the parent has to approach the adult that is being inappropriately friendly with their child?
Pretty much. That's the way I would see it, that there will be have to be some type of...
Are there support groups out there to help the parents before they go into that, I guess is where I'm going. Is there some place that, you know, a parent can go and say, I need help with how to do this so that it doesn't escalate into something, or so that I don't accuse somebody of something that's really not going on?
I'm not aware of any agencies or organizations that do that. But you raise a very valid question, but I think maybe a course of action that could be considered in that situation would be for the parent to insinuate themselves into that relationship. We're doing a lot of camping trips. I'd like to go camping with you. You know, we're going to a tournament. Great. Let me come along. And of course, the red flags really pop up if they say, "Well, you know, we really, you know, don't have enough cars for you to come along, or we don't need it." Why can't I be there? And you can certainly learn more about what's going on. At the least, as you say, put the the would-be predator on guard that, hey, you know what, this is not going to be easy for you to move on. And perhaps it's best to show yourself that it is a healthy and appropriate relationship. So now, this is not an ideal solution, but sometimes, you know, parents just got to step up and without accusing anybody, make sure you are aware of what's going on.
So a parent, you know, and this may take some work, but a parent can be aggressive without being accusatory.
Right. It comes down to knowing who your children's friends are, whether they are other children or they are other adults, but that you know what's going on with their lives. I think there's a billboard out there that says the bus driver knows who your kids hang out with after school. Do you?
Yeah.
You know, and then it's very true that you should know what's going on with their lives. And what happened to the days of everybody knew about everybody's parents, that, you know, you knew the parents of the kids that your kids played with. And so maybe going back to some of that and knowing where your children go when they leave the house and things like that.
Well, does this also involve, you know, creating neighborhoods again? I know that's a social task that it may be impossible in this day and age, but where I grew up, if I was, you know, getting in trouble or causing mischief, my parents didn't need to see me. They were going to get a call from the neighbor 5 to 8 blocks over. Because, you know, and of course I grew up in a small town, but a small town is like a neighborhood, you know, really. So when I got in trouble, and I did, I was a mischievous kid.
I'll be all about you.
Really. Yeah, not me. Mom and Dad got a call, and they were waiting for me at home, you know. Say, what was up? What was going on? What were you doing? Why were you doing that? And I got the third degree, and I knew that, you know, everybody was watching, so I had to go to the next town over if I was going to misbehave, you know. And riding my bike to the next town over was not a good proposition, you know, in those days.
I think you make a good point, and that is this stuff doesn't stand up well in the sunlight. If there are a lot of people involved, other parents, then there's just not much opportunity, or at least there's less opportunity for misbehavior. One of the disadvantages we have with that situation is that we typically, perhaps more so in the South, but we typically teach our children to respect and obey adults, period. And while I certainly think that's an admirable value, I hope is maintained and perpetuated, we need to include, you know, rather than say, do what whatever the babysitter says or you're going to be in trouble, say, do what you know is right, because that's what I expect of you. And the admonition is just a little different, but it can make a huge amount of difference when that 5-year-old is trying to think very concretely. He says, Mom said do what the babysitter said, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes those instructions are too black and white, you know, without some parameters on it. The child thinks, well, I have to do what the babysitter says. And
young children are concrete. Oh, hey, mister, are you a stranger?
So we had a question online. I think we've partly covered it, but partly not. And that is, very often I know several of the cases of murders in the state that I've just moved from Florida, the perpetrators were released sexual offenders. They had been prosecuted. A couple had been found guilty, but they were released early. And the community did not know that they had moved into their community. Of course, that's created a whole spate of laws. I know that there is an FBI site, I believe, that lists convicted sexual offenders.
There are hundreds of sites.
Yeah. Is there too many sites? there one repository that I know if I go to that, I'm going to find out whether, you know, Joe across the street is actually, you know.
Well, the way it actually works is it's a network. If you go to Family Watchdog or if you go to the National Sex Offender Registry, they're all going to lead back to the registering agency. The registering agency for Caddo Parish is Caddo Parish Sheriff's Office.
Okay.
The Shreveport Police Department also registers convicted sex offenders, but the one you see online is the Caddo Sheriff's Office. Any of these sites are going to take you back to their database.
And not to put either the police department or the prosecutors, but, you know, sometimes things are pleaded out that maybe should have been prosecuted more fully. What can the community do to support both the police departments and the prosecutors to make sure that an actual sexual crime especially against children, but any sexual crime is prosecuted as such.
I think it all comes down to legislators. And I will say this for them, that there have been laws about sex crimes since I have been in the sex crimes unit for 11 years. They have passed new laws every single year. Mm-hmm. They just did a total revamping of the sex offender registration laws thanks to the federal Adam Walsh Act. So they're trying. They're trying to get them better, and they're trying to get stiffer penalties.
Is there... go ahead.
I was going to say, I know sometimes plea bargaining is necessary to get some kind of conviction when you may not be able to get any conviction at all. But we do know that certainly the majority of convicted violent sexual offenders have previous convictions for violent actions or for sexual exploitation. And a large number of them are on probation or parole for previous offenses. So what do you do the first time? I'm not sure. But we certainly know that recidivism is a very common phenomenon.
And it's, I think, one of the most frightening things is that someone has a history of doing this. They get out, they move into your neighborhood, and they completely change their profile so that maybe the database lists them, but they're hiding. And I'm sure that that does go on.
Yes, there are some that believe that, that registration actually drives them underground. A lot of them are still on probation and parole. What we found, I've been registering sex offenders for about 5 or 6 years now. What I found is the majority of them will do the right thing. If they're on probation, they always do the right thing. But as soon as someone's not watching them anymore, those are the ones that slip through the cracks. It is a pretty much a part-time job. It's on top of it. In our department, we are tasked with the sex crimes registration as well as brand new sex offenses. The Caddo Sheriff's Office does it within their jail. This is still law enforcement agencies trying to figure out how to handle the problem and how to deal with it appropriately. But we have approximately, I think, 382 registered sex offenders living in the city of Shreveport that we know about. There's been as high as numbers as up as 550, I believe. The sheriff's office has about 100 more that we don't have because they live in the parish. It is a network of agencies of trying to track these guys, but just because they register and they do everything they're supposed to do as far as the law doesn't mean they're not going to reoffend.
Before we close out the hour, are there any things that I didn't touch upon, any questions or things that you feel like you would like to share with particular parents out there, that here are some things that you can do to really help shield your child a little better, help educate your child a little better, or educate yourself?
For me, younger children, ask them. I had a 5-year-old child say she hadn't told her mom yet because she hadn't asked her. That she used to ask her once a year. They had an anniversary, and it wasn't that time yet, so she was just waiting to be asked. Ask your children often, and not specifically, is anybody touching you? Is anybody making you uncomfortable or doing something you're not okay with? And as far as older children, getting them to recognize their own boundaries.
I agree completely with what Detective Marino said, and I would suggest that talking to your children about possible sexual exploitation in a way that's going to be productive starts with just talking to your children about their worries, about what they're excited about their friends and what they're doing, being a part of their lives, and understanding that the page you colored at school or whether or not we're going to have a party in second grade may not be a big deal to the parent, but it's as big in the child's life as anything that happens to the adults. So be a part of your children's lives. Keep the lines of communication start open. Keeping them open is a two-way deal that involves probably the parents more than children.
All right, as the music can tell you in the background, we're about out of time. Detective Marino and Dr. McCormick, I want to thank you very much for being with us this evening, and we appreciate you sharing your time and being on Health Matters tonight.
We're glad to do that.
This has been Health Matters, protecting our children from sexual predators, and our guests have been Detective Paula Marino with the Shreveport Police Department Sex Crime Unit and Dr. Bruce McCormick, a medical and family psychologist. For a list of some resources on the topic tonight, you can go to our website, www.redriverradio.org and click on the resources link under the Health Matters banner on our homepage. Copies of this show will be available on our website in a short while. Just go again to redriverradio.org and click on the Audio On Demand button on the top navigation bar and then look for Health Matters, Protecting Our Children. For Red River Radio, I'm Bill Beckett, and this is Red River Radio, your public radio service from LSUS.